Hello everyone and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where I, Rod Jones, Content Manager, and Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute, take a critical look at what's been happening in the world of leadership and management up to the 5th of October 2020. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Well, our first story, Kate, we ask if organisations should reimagine anti-racism training. Barrister and author Alexandra Wilson has called for improved anti-racism training in her profession, following her recent widely publicised tweets in which she described how court officials mistook her for a defendant three times on a single day. In a column for The Independent, Wilson writes, "The fact that other black people in my profession weren't surprised by my experience after I shared it on Twitter last week highlights how much of a systemic issue this is." Wilson stresses, "There needs to be change. All court staff, barristers, solicitors, and anyone else working in the justice system should have compulsory anti-racist training that goes further than current equality and diversity guidance. Training is rarely nuanced and all minority experiences are grouped into a single BAME experience rather than dealing with racism that affects specific groups such as black people." Kate, what can organisations do to ensure that such training is nuanced in the way that Wilson suggests so that it properly accounts for the experiences of specific ethnicities?
Well, Rod, if we look at the history of unconscious bias training and racial awareness training, it was essentially a compliance activity to make sure that organisations complied with anti-discrimination legislation. So it isn't really surprising it isn't fit for purpose now. But what we do have, of course, is all these first-person accounts of how people from different minority groups have experienced exclusion in the workplace. And they're the people to ask about what the training should be going forward. What sort of things, insidious things, hidden things in a way, happen that make you feel excluded. So that's one sort of training. But at the same time, we cannot make the responsibility for educating everybody the minority group's responsibility. So at an organisation level, we have to design training programmes that are meant to address the challenge of creating a much more diverse and inclusive workforce. So you there have a combination of top down and bottom up. And I think that will lead to this nuanced training that Wilson is calling for.
Thank you very much, Kate. Well, our next story asks, how can firms empower female workers through the current pandemic? Several years of progress that US women have achieved in white-collar jobs could be completely wiped out as a result of the pandemic, according to research from leanin.org in the latest edition of its annual Women in the Workplace report, produced in partnership with McKinsey & Co. Due to challenges created by the COVID-19 crisis, as many as 2 million women are considering taking a leave of absence or leaving the workforce altogether. If these women feel forced to leave the workforce, we'll end up with far fewer women in leadership and far fewer women on track to be future leaders. All the progress we've seen over the past 6 years would be erased. In the report's consideration, female workers are struggling with unsustainable pressure and anxiety stemming from increased housework and caregiving burdens, being able to talk about them with their manager, or suddenly being blindsided by unanticipated events. Sheryl Sandberg, CEO of Facebook, writes that during the pandemic, no one is experiencing business as usual, so employers should consider resetting goals and extending deadlines wherever possible. Kate, would such measures make a difference to women's lives? And what other steps should organisations take to empower their female staff at this challenging time?
Well, firstly, I think Sheryl Sandberg's call for more compassion, to be more understanding about the multiple demands that female workers, if they are parents or other sorts of caregivers, are experiencing. But this goes right back almost to 20 or 30 years ago, when the role of women in work, because they were paid so much less, that if they were in a heterosexual relationship, likely that their male partner was being paid more, therefore it always made more sense for the woman to give up work, take extended maternity leave, as it was called then. So this is another example of what happens at a micro level is absolutely an important negotiation that in whatever sort of households that people's jobs are given equal status and the lower earning one isn't dismissed as less important because women are building their careers and stepping out of the workforce, as we know, hinders progress when one returns. But also for organisations to think, well, how can we help? How can we help people who are juggling schoolwork, caring, unexpected events such as a school suddenly being closed and all the sorts of things we hear about. But with so many of these complex problems, for the individual, it's the help that they need there for their situation. And no amount of organisational policies and guidelines are going to be a substitute for empathetic leadership and management where it matters.
Thank you, Kate. And looking at empathetic management, our next story is a widely reported story about how I monitor my staff with software that takes screenshots. Shibu Philip is the founder of Transcend, a small London-based firm that buys beauty products wholesale and resells them online. And for the last year and a half, he has used Upstaff software to track his workers' hours, keystrokes, mouse movements. With 7 employees based in India, he says the software ensures there is some level of accountability and helps plug the time difference. It's good to have an automatic way of monitoring what my employees are up to, says Shibu. And by looking at screenshots and how much time everyone is taking on certain tasks, I know if they're following procedures. And if they're doing better than I expected, I will also study the photos and ask them to share that knowledge with the rest of the team so we can all improve, he says. Kate, can the use of such software ever be justified?
Well, as you say, this story has been widely reported and we've heard a lot from Shibu. We haven't heard anything from the staff that he's monitoring. And we know if you set targets for people, you track, you monitor people, they will always find creative ways of getting around them. So I'd be really interested to see how they're making sure that they do the optimum number of keystrokes, mouse movements and websites visited. And it might not be exactly as Shibu thinks it is. It seems from the accounts we've heard that this is incredibly one way. This is all about his need for control and him thinking that if he controls people like that, then they're going to share their best practice willingly when he seems to be sending a message that he doesn't really trust them. So there will be another side to this. It would be great if those people would speak up, or other people that are monitored in this way, to say what it's like for them. Because until we hear their side of the story, can we ever really agree on whether it's a good thing or actually does it undermine trust?
Thank you, Kate. Our final story is a survey by FlexJobs and Mental Health America that found that 3/4 of workers have experienced burnout at work. 40% also said they've experienced burnout during the pandemic, which the survey sees as not surprising, as 37% report they are working longer hours since the pandemic started. However, only 1 in 5 of the 1,500 respondents said that HR offered productive solutions to burnout issues. Carol Cochran, VP of People and Culture at FlexJobs, stated that one of the most important things remote workers can do is to set clear boundaries between their work time and non-work time, and HR needs to take an active role in helping workers practice healthy boundaries between their professional and personal lives. Offering flexible scheduling to employees can have a dramatic impact on reducing burnout, since rigid work schedules usually magnify conflict between work and family, leading workers to mental exhaustion. Kate, how can leaders best create a healthy culture that prioritises the well-being of its employees?
Well, this is such a good example of where role modelling is so much part of the answer. So if you have a manager who is actively trying to ensure that he or she isn't burning out, is managing to manage those boundaries, has realistic expectations of what everyone can contribute at this time, you're going to have a culture where it's okay to say, look, I've got too much on, or I cannot do any more this week. Because burnout, of course, is a hugely unwanted result. We might get more hours of work early on, and then that will result in time off work, leading overall to lower productivity. So HR absolutely should be offering advice, but it is for the managers of people to keep an eye on them, to make sure they're not sending emails at ridiculous hours, that their working day isn't stretched. Because even if you cannot see the impact it's having on people's home lives, you can be pretty confident that they're, as it's saying here, that those sorts of conflicts are not doing anybody any good. So role model good behaviours, be very mindful of what people are doing, and be understanding. And this is such an important topic that we actually have a webinar on it this week. So please make sure, if you're not able to actually attend at the time, please do download it, because all our webinars are made available after the event.
Thank you very much, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod.